This episode of Table Talk is sponsored by Berry Brothers and Rudd, Britain's oldest wine and spirit merchant. It isn't possible at the moment to go to your favourite restaurant because restaurants are closed. But Berry Brothers and Rudd have nobly stepped into the breach with their fantastic new at-home service. Berry's will send a magnificent three-course meal directly to your house, and they'll also provide the ideal wine or wines to go with the food. What a delicious idea. Go to spectator.co.uk/Berry Brothers to find out more.
Hello and welcome to Table Talk, the Spectator's food and drink podcast. I'm Olivia Potts.
And I'm Laura Prendergast.
And today we are delighted to be joined by Geordie Willis. Geordie is the creative director and brand experiences director of Berry Brothers and Rudd, Britain's oldest wine merchants. He's the eighth generation of his family to work in the business, which was founded in 1698 and holds the royal warrant. Geordie, welcome to Table Talk.
Thank you for having me.
Geordie, as listeners will know, we always start this podcast with the same question. What are your earliest memories of food?
My earliest memories of food, well, I'm told I was a fussy eater, which I don't necessarily agree with, but there's one story that always comes to mind, which is it's slightly apocryphal because I don't remember it myself, but my mother came back one day to find my grandmother who had been looking after us. I have a twin sister and we were both being looked after for the day, to find us both screaming and howling with tears. And my mother tried to work out what was going on, and there was a plate of what looked like custard in front of us. And it was only when she checked that she realised that my grandmother had been feeding us homemade mayonnaise. So there was good reason. There was good reason that I was a little bit tentative about food. But my mother was a very good cook, so I grew up eating well, lots of delicious, so somewhere between nursery food and dinner party food is probably how I would describe it. Lots of fish pies and macaroni cheeses and shepherd's pies and that sort of stuff.
And are those things that you still enjoy today?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think that we're in a world at the moment where comfort food ticks a lot of boxes. Yeah, I still make that sort of food. I'm lucky that not in the current climate, but in the old world, I used to be lucky enough to eat out and visit a lot of restaurants, particularly in London. But I think we're all eating at home in a rather different way these days, aren't we?
Yeah, definitely. And what were meal times like when you were younger?
Probably scrambling for food with my twin. I remember lots of crispy pancakes, Finder's crispy pancakes, and pizza feet, which I suspect would be crossed off the list by Jamie Oliver these days.
I feel like Finder's pancakes come up a lot on this podcast. People obviously have very fond memories.
I think so. I remember them. I don't think I dare try them again now, because they might not be quite as delicious as I remember, but I suspect you've been talking to people of my generation. I'm sure that there's a group of us who all were weaned on crispy pancakes, I suspect.
And what about school food? Were you a fan?
School food was good. I grew up in Scotland. I was halfway between Aberdeen and Dundee, and we were fed delicious things like stovies, which was sort of a mixture of sort of leftovers, I think is probably how you describe them down south, but potatoes and lamb or beef and onions, and I remember that being delicious. And I remember all of those school foods that you'd probably not see so much of these days, semolina and tapioca, which I couldn't stand. And then milkshake. We often, it was probably once in a blue moon, but we got given a glass of chocolate or strawberry milkshake, which was a little bit like sort of Angel Delight sort of thing, which was the absolute best thing that we could possibly imagine. I still lust over it.
I have to ask, given that it's Burns Night today when we're recording, and obviously you grew up in Scotland, also our editor has just given everyone in the office haggis. Are you a fan of haggis?
I love haggis. All that sort of stuff, haggis or black pudding or anything a little bit offaly, I'm quite keen on. So, yeah, no, haggis, I think, has a bad rap, but I think most people, once they've tried it, are converted. Maybe not all, but yeah, big fan.
And what about sort of big occasions when you were growing up, birthdays or Christmases? Were there lots of family piling in, or was it bijou? How did it work in your family?
It was probably not lots of family. We were quite spread out. My grandparents were based down south, and my other grandparents, even though they were close in Scottish standards, were an hour and a half away. So I remember those sort of long Sunday lunches with my grandparents, where my grandmother would feed us with an awful lot of, do you remember the giant tubes of Smarties that were all the rage back in the 80s and 90s, and we would we would probably pile through a whole packet of those on the way home and then feel sick for a week. So I remember lots of things like that. And my grandmother on that side, who probably was a good cook, I was about to be rather unfair, but she would make these slightly elaborate dishes for young people, the sort of things that we weren't very good at, things that had texture. And I remember jelly with nectarine pieces and things like that in it, which from a textural perspective was quite disgusting to me.
Challenging.
My grandfather was very loyal and would sit at the end of the table and say, best ever, darling, best ever. And we would be sort of hiding it down on our laps in the nap.
That is so charming. I wonder if I can train my husband into that.
Do you know what? It probably took 50 years of training. He was very good at it. But,
start now.
Geordie, tell us about, obviously you come from a very long line of wine merchants. When do you remember when you had your first glass of wine?
My first glass of wine. I think, do you know what, I would love to tell you the romantic story about sipping on a first grape or something like that, but I think we probably were helping ourselves to the woodpecker cider in the larder rather than wine in the early days. I grew up with wine, I suppose, when I was with my grandparents. My grandfather, who was chairman of Berry Brothers, was pretty relaxed on the wine front. So we were, in the sort of French fashion, we were probably allowed a sip quite early on. But it was probably a little bit later that that he would ever start educating us on it. I suppose through osmosis he was educating us all the time, but I don't remember necessarily the first glass. He was actually quite humble. One assumes that wine merchants drink extraordinarily well at home, but it's not always the case. He was a child of two world wars, and we would have Riesling, always Riesling, and sort of at the time it was Chilean Merlot with a screw cap, because at that point, this is quite a lot later on, he found the screw cap easier than the corkscrew, so there was a little bit of practicality that went there, but we were very lucky to drink some nice wines. I don't think he wasted the nice wines on the children, probably.
Whilst we've said already that you are the eighth generation of your family in Berry Brothers and Rudd, it's not a sort of automatic thing that you go into the family business. Am I right in saying it's obligatory that you, if you're going to go into the business, you have to do 3 years elsewhere? Is that right?
Yeah, interestingly, it didn't seem to be obligatory until I came along. They sort of launched the rules. There were many rules that came about on my arrival, which is probably quite telling. But I was working in the magazine world, which back then, this is going back to probably 2000, 2001, was so appallingly paid if you wanted to get into the magazine world that I think we got paid £60 a week for the pleasure of being in the magazine, which was great fun. Admittedly, one couldn't afford the bus ride, but you got fed canapés like a king in the evening at various different events. And I decided that the best thing to do would be to try and find a Saturday job, and applied for a job in the cellars in St James's, which I did slightly under the cover of darkness, and I ended up working down there for about 3 years. And I was called upstairs one day by my uncle, who was several floors above the cellars. And I assumed that I was going to be promoted. I was fairly convinced as I was heading up. Normally, if you're called to the chairman's office, you're probably slightly nervous about what's going to happen. And I was convinced I was about to be given a sort of golden key to promotion. And I walked in and he said, "When are you leaving?" And I said, what do you mean, when am I leaving? I've only just arrived. And he said, "Well, you've read your contract." And I said, well, the two important parts, which is about holiday and money, probably. And he said, "Well, on page 12, paragraph 2, there's a very important part that says that you have to do what they refer to as an enforced sabbatical. So you had to go and work somewhere else." And this was all because he had been recently to do a course at Harvard, which was a brilliant course on sort of families and business. And it taught you that actually it's so important in a family business to learn outside the business as well as inside the business. So there are many, many good habits that one picks up in a family business, and particularly around the values and so on. But you also are perhaps a little bit limited unless you get experience elsewhere. So I was sort of sent off into the wilderness, as it were, and then actually ended up in Hong Kong. I rejoined the business by moving out to Hong Kong, which is possibly where my real love for food came from, being in a completely different space.
How did you begin your education about wine? It obviously presumably started with your grandfather telling you about it all, but I mean, what was the process by which you learnt about wine?
I think there was a little bit at my grandfather's table. A lot of it was working in the cellars, actually, because you would recognise wines. One of the joys of working at Berry Brothers is that the people who tend to drink best are the most senior executives and the most lowly cellarmen, because your job in the cellars is often decanting wines that will go up to the director's dining room. So if you are anywhere between that, you may be missing out. But if you are working in the cellars, you get to try these extraordinary wines. You know, sometimes, you know, almost I can think of decanting 1890 Bordeaux and best of the first gross and so on and so forth. And your opportunity was to try those to make sure that by the time they got to table, they were fit for consumption, which of course they all were. We were tasting them out of it was a joy to be tasting them. So I suppose that's where it started. And then I did all my exams, and the rest has been through really just being in the business for so long, I suppose. And you soak it up over time.
You just mentioned the dining room, and some listeners might not be aware that there is a dining room above Berry, above the shop floor in Berry's. Can you tell us a bit about that? And I mean,
absolutely. So Berry Brothers, a lot of people think that Berry Brothers is this rather small archaic shop on St James's Street. So if you look at it from the outside, it is much photographed, and in the old days very few people would ever step in the door there. It was terrifying to walk inside this sort of Dickensian shop front. However, it is much bigger than it looks. So we're the size of 2 football pitches below ground, 12 buildings above ground. And for many years, we've been feeding people as well. So the thing about wine, and if you've interviewed, I'm sure, a few wine people. Actually, I listened to Dan Keeling from Noble Rot, who's an old friend of mine. And he was saying that wine often makes very little sense unless you have food to go with it. And as a business, for probably 100 years now, we've been doing business over lunch. In the old days, that really was doing business over lunch. The directors would have lunch every day. They would arrive around 10 o'clock, probably have a gin and tonic around 11:30, and then head up to lunch for a 2 or 3 hour lunch, depending on who was there. And then you go home at 4:30 in the afternoon, which was a very different business to the business we work in today. But about 20 years ago, we started bringing people in and doing events downstairs as well. And that was supposed to be quite small. We had these extraordinary cellars, and we wanted to show people more of them. But originally, we thought ambitiously we'd do 50 events a year. That was our idea. And the managing director at the time said to us, "You're not being ambitious enough. You can probably do 75. And in a normal year, and I know we're not in a normal year, but in a normal year, we would be doing almost 50 a week at the moment, certainly before Christmas. So that opportunity to bring people together and to host them within our space has been something that we've loved doing for years, actually.
And people get themselves tied up into knots over pairing food and wine. Is there a knack to it? Is there a trick? Or is it really just learning as you go?
I suppose the first thing is not to be scared of it. If you think of rules as guidance rather than rules, I suppose is the starting point. And there are lots of things that, you know, we hear about white wine and fish. And then, of course, there's the second part of that with people who think they're very clever, saying, of course, you can have red wine and fish and all these sort of things. So a little bit of knowledge takes you a long way. The simple thing always, and this is something which is not told to me necessarily by some of our masters of wine, but by Stuart Turner, who's our chef, who's a font of all knowledge when it comes to wine and food, is that you start with the region. So if you think about the food you're eating, if you're having a delicious Italian dish, you can't really go wrong with a delicious Italian wine. So if you start thinking about food and wine coming from the same place, that's probably not a bad place to start. And you can do that in restaurants as well. If you're in a restaurant and you're having a particular type of cuisine, then you can lean quite quickly on the wine from that region and not go too far wrong. Or the other thing that we have to remember is really, really helpful is the sommelier, who, again, most people think is a slightly terrifying character who's there purely to make you spend more money on wine. But actually, if you're interested in wine, the sommelier should and could and will be your best friend. I very rarely these days look at a wine list. I will speak directly to the sommelier and say, this is the sort of food we're going to be eating. This is the sort of, importantly, the sort of money I'm hoping to spend, and try and give us something interesting or exciting that we wouldn't have had before, which I think is much nicer. If you're at dinner, you don't really want to be thinking too much about, especially if you do it for the day job. I think it's always a bit of a busman's holiday. If inevitably, you get past the wine list before you've even sat down. Which takes away from my enjoyment a little bit.
I was going to ask, actually, I thought of this because Dan actually wrote a drinks column for us last week talking about how now's the time to open all those bottles that you've been saving, because sort of, why not? What have you been eating and also drinking during lockdown?
It's a very good question. Well, probably the first thing to say is it's been slightly embarrassing. My flat at the moment, the oven part of my flat, is not working particularly well at the moment. So I've become the master of the hob. So I'm trying to be quite healthy. And actually, and I shouldn't probably say this, I'm trying not to be drinking too much, because I think lockdown and drinking too much is potentially quite a slippery slope. And we're so lucky that when we are at work, we drink so well. So I've gone straight back to comfort food. We'll make a sort of pepperonata or something like that, and try and keep it. I've got suddenly very into soups, which I think is the most dull thing in the entire world.
Oh, I think that's a January thing. I think that's very understandable.
I feel like I've been probably the most contact I've had with my mother in a long time is over soup recipes.
And which ones in particular have you bonded over?
Oh, goodness. I think spinach and pea. I did a very good carrot one. I mean, it's so easy, isn't it, doing a good soup, so you can't really go wrong. So I've quite enjoyed that. And I'm trying generally to keep it healthy, but I suppose that's a January thing as well.
And what about when we emerge from this strange life that we've been living for the last year? Where are you looking forward to being able to eat and drink again?
I think that I would be, let's see, I love Noble Rot, and I haven't been to their new restaurant yet. I think there is no better wine and food restaurant in London at the moment. I really believe that. And in that sort of cheers mentality where you go to places where people know you and you feel relaxed straight away, I think it encapsulates that even for people who haven't been there before. I think that there are a lot of places. There's a place called Maison Francois, which is just open in St. James's and open for all of 5 seconds before the second lockdown came. And I managed to squeeze in one meal there, and I'm looking forward to going back there and trying it again. I think we're all going to be pretty ready for a restaurant meal. When we emerge, I think there's a lot on my list at the moment, and a lot that I'd love to be jumping into at the moment. But we'll see when we emerge is probably the main thing.
And just finally, Geordie, we normally end by asking what would be your desert island meal.
Well, let's think. Well, the thing at the moment is you will have come across a lot of these restaurants that are delivering food. And we're doing that now as well with a company called Big Night. And if you haven't interviewed those guys yet, then you should. They're brilliant. A guy called Charlie Mellor, who has the restaurant called The Laughing Heart in Shoreditch, and a guy called James Murray, who's ex-Clove Club front of house. So there's definitely food on that list, which I'm interested in at the moment. In terms of a sort of desert island food, probably, I lived in San Francisco last year for about 6 months, and there was a place called Hookfish, which was a tiny, tiny little burrito place, and I genuinely dream about it once a week. It was the most extraordinary fresh fish straight from the ocean. So I lust after that, and then possibly, I suppose we always say our sort of mother's cooking to a certain extent, a sort of lasagna or a shepherd's pie or something along those lines.
Is there a bottle that you'd...
If I was being excitable and going for something special, something like a 1990 Montrose, Bordeaux, I tend to sort of drift away into new exciting wine regions, and I return to Bordeaux quite a lot. So something like a Montrose or a Left Bank Bordeaux would do the trick very nicely, I think.
Geordie, thank you so much for joining Table Talk.
Thank you for joining us on The Spectator's Food and Drink podcast. For more recipes, food history, stories and drinks, you can head to the Spectator website.